The TV game show Match Game was canceled in 1963 for being too bland and not connecting with viewers. Figuring you can't get canceled twice, the show's writers put in cheeky questions designed to make contestants blush at the celebrity panel's witty banter and sexual innuendo. Match Game won audiences back over and stayed on the air till 1969. The show came back to life as Match Game 73 and was nominated for several Emmys. Its hilarious risque humor changed the tone of all daytime TV game shows forever.
Today, camp culture historian A. Ashley Hoff takes us on a backstage tour of Match Game, the orange shag-carpeted TV game show where our favorite gay icons cracked up the audience as they filled in the blank over cocktails. Ashley's book, Match Game 101, is an in-depth look into the making of the iconic game show and features interviews with the fabulous celebrities who made host Gene Rayburn's circus come to life as the hottest cocktail party on TV.
Listen as we blank with Ashley about Brett Summers, Fanny Flagg, Richard Dawson, and why Mae West was never a celebrity guest.
Charles Nelson Reilly's wonderfully queer showbiz career, from Broadway to Sid and Marty Krofft's Lidsville, to life as one of the most beloved talk show personalities.
And Evie Phineas, the most awkward game show contestant in history. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. Feast of Fun is made possible because of fierce, fabulous people just like you.
Visit feastoffun.com/plus and become a member today, because your blank is what makes the show happen.
Thank you.
Charles, what'd you say?
I said logically a garter.
A garter, right.
Sorry.
Well, nobody wears garters anymore, Charles.
I do.
Oh, he doesn't even wear socks.
He doesn't take the subway anymore.
Yeah, but he likes garters. He doesn't wear the socks, just the garters.
You see what I have to put up.
Hello, hello.
Hi, is this A. Ashley Hoff?
This is indeed.
Hi, Ashley. This is Fausto Fernos. I'm joined here by my beautiful co-host, Mark Fillion.
I've got my cigarette and martini here, and I'm ready to win big money for you today.
Mark, why don't you read the line as it's written? Thank you.
I screwed up my line. Sorry. Where is it?
That's all right. I am thrilled to talk with you guys. I'm thrilled to have a formal introduction. I've been listening to your podcast, and so I'm a big fan and fellow Chicagoan from, you know, at least I used to be. I'm now in the winter climes of Los Angeles.
Well, welcome to Feast of Fun, Ashley. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I am a writer, author of Match Game 101, a backstage history of Match Game.
And where do you live?
I actually live in Los Angeles.
Don't get anybody ready for this show. You're supposed to tell us where you're from, what you do for
exactly.
a living,
How
and your
many
hobbies.
Kids you have.
Exactly. I of all people, I blew it. But
Well, this is very aligned with Match Game because they always would mess things up, and that's what made the show really fun.
Well, the thing was Gene Rayburn, because he had such a background in radio and especially morning talk radio, he had honed his skills doing that and then early live television. So he was a master of improv. So no matter what went wrong, he was able to just go with it. And unlike a lot of shows or other hosts who might have to stop and then, you know, go back to their marks and then, you know, pick up the shot, Gene would just go with it, and he was okay no matter what happened, no matter what people said. The panelists would just come up with things off the top of their head, and banter would ensue, and, you know, he was fine with it. He was easy with it. He was very easygoing.
So what does the A in Ashley stand for?
My very first name, which I do not necessarily love, but I do think initial A. Ashley Hoff looks terribly dignified on a book cover.
Mm. So the A stands for absolutely nothing?
Yeah, well, we'll go with that.
Oh, what do we call you?
Just Ashley. I mean, if you wanted to go with Ashley, it would sound awfully pretentious. But
it
that's
sounds
all
like
right.
I have a stutter.
I'm a little pretentious.
Ashley. No, but so the A is a private name, and so because the feds are looking for you, we can't spill that on the show.
Pretty much.
Oh well, that's great. So we have somebody who's running for the law for stealing people's hearts.
Oh, that's so sweet.
So, Ashley, tell us about when you first saw Match Game. Like, for us as kids, we used to watch it on daytime television when we stayed home from school because we were faking a cold because we wanted to skip taking a test.
Well, that's the best way to do it. Or on summer vacation, you know, when you're, you know, sitting in the family room with the gold shag carpeting and you're parked with your index cards and your magic markers playing along with Fanny and everybody. I grew up watching the show. I mean, I saw it. And then, of course, they've shown it in reruns on the Game Show Network and then now on Buzzr for over 20 years. I mean, they were playing in the late 90s, I think, in reruns. And even as a child, I knew who people like Charles Nelson Reilly were. I remember seeing, when I lived in Chicago, seeing a production of The Gin Game over at the Royal George Theater. And it starred Charles Durning and Julie Harris, but it had been directed by Charles Nelson Reilly. And I knew of Charles because, you know, you're never going to, once you see Charles Nelson Reilly in action, you're never going to forget him.
But for you, like when you first became familiar with the TV show, you were probably like a child, right?
I was but a wee tot. Basically, the book itself came about because I was sitting around with a friend watching a rerun of Match Game. This was in 2002. And yeah. I turned to him because they've done books on every TV show. You know, there are a million Lucy books. There are a million Mayberry books. But you never see game show books. And I turned to him and I said, to your knowledge, did anybody ever write a book on Match Game? He couldn't think of anyone. But as it turned out, he worked with Kay Henley, who back in the 70s had worked as celebrity coordinator on Match Game. And I got very excited and I said, well, she should write a book because, I mean, if she did, I'd buy it right in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
And he basically provided the introduction. He introduced me to her and I basically repeated that. And she basically said she didn't want to write a book, but she said, if you want to write a book, I'll gladly talk to you for it. And so it began as kind of a, well, ha ha ha, somebody should write a book on Match Game. And since nobody else was chomping at the bit, I just thought, okay, what the hell? I'm going to give it a try. I had absolutely no clue where to start.
Because you were like even trying to learn how to read and write at the time.
pretty much. I mean, this was 2002. Yeah. This was before Facebook or before any, this was even probably before Friendster. I mean, you couldn't exactly, the only way you could stalk celebrities was to actually look them up in either the White Pages or, you know, look them up through the unions, SAG and AFTRA, which were separate at the time, and say, hi, who is the contact representative for this person?
But do you remember where you were the first time Charles Nelson Reilly made a sexual innuendo on daytime television?
Are you ready to go on?
Yes.
That means now you play for 5,000. To collect, you got to match one of them head to head. Has to be exact. Time to choose one.
Charles.
Charles, are
you
ready?
Your reign is over, Philip. The women are turning toward me. The party is over.
All over my
because your
breath.
Robe fascinates them, Charles.
Where were you?
Where was I? I was probably like 7. So it all went over my head, but I just knew these people were hilarious. Mm-hmm. I loved Brett Summers. I loved Fanny Flagg. And I just knew that these people were fabulous, even if I had no real words for it, no real concept of it. I just knew they were great. We had a close friend of the family named Madge, who had the same kind of personality. She had the rough gravel voice. She was, of course, a chain smoker. And, you know, she and her husband, Hal, he as it turns out, had a boat, and he would often wear a Greek fisherman's cap, kind of the Greek captain's cap, kind of like what Charles would wear on the show. And he had the two, you know, the tinted sunglasses, and he also chain smoked. So they both looked and sounded a lot like Charles and Brett. And so I kind of, in my mind, it's like I grew up with them in a sense.
Well, the thing about it is, for us as kids, we never, I'm from Puerto Rico, and when we watched the show, we were more attracted to the fact that the contestants were really nervous and wincing at the bravado of the celebrities. And so in our minds, we were thinking American celebrities were these party goers who had so much fun, drank and smoked and fucked all the time, and then most people were just like gasping for it.
Well, that's what it kind of was in the 70s. I mean, it really was that kind of Playboy Club era the post-Playboy Club era, when everybody, you know, would go on Johnny Carson and they'd sit down and they'd have a drink. They obviously had something, you know, in the green room before they came out. And they would sit and they would talk. And if, you know, some really attractive starlet came out, I don't know, Lonnie Anderson or whomever, or my good friend Teresa Ganzel would come out and do a skit, and she'd be wearing something that just kind of showed off her figure, and you know, they'd say, hey sweetie, you know, do a turnaround, let's take a look at your gown, and you know, they would turn around and show off their gown, and they'd say, oh yes, aren't I cute? And that was the era. It was accepted at that time. And of course, now we cringe and think, wow, that's pretty misogynistic.
Pretty
nobody
forward.
Exactly made Johnny Carson, you know, turn around and show off his tush or that sort of thing. Maybe they should have.
So in the early 70s, you know, it was a time of political turmoil. And, you know, the FCC changed the regulation for reruns and game shows, and so made it possible for a lot of television companies to start taping shows with the goal of creating reruns. And so in that time period, a lot of game shows that were normally taped in New York City moved to California, and that changed the tone and the atmosphere of what we think of television game shows. What was the early 70s like for like Charles Nelson Reilly and Gene Rayburn and Brett Summers and Richard Dawson?
Well, first of all, we have to go back slightly earlier, because there actually had been an earlier version of Match Game shot out of New York, and that ran from New Year's Eve 1962 through to 1969 before the show finally, you know, was canceled. And then during that interim time is when Goodson Todman Productions moved from their New York offices to Los Angeles. They were located on the Sunset Boulevard building that now houses CNN.
But the first iteration in the 60s, that show was much different than the show that came out in the 70s, right?
It was very dry.
Yeah, it was a much more staid, cerebral kind of show. And because they didn't really tape shows with the idea of showing reruns, because they thought to themselves, well, who's going to watch a rerun of a game show? They had a few additional copies on hand just so if for some reason they couldn't tape that day, or for some reason there was something that that took place, they would have a quick replacement copy. But for the most part, they never bothered recording or for any kind of posterity these shows. When the 70s came around, you know, Match Game 73 premiered, and they taped that. They luckily have all the episodes, save for a few that have been set aside because of, you know, political incorrectness in answers or language or whatever. But generally speaking, you know, all those episodes are still existing and still known to exist. And luckily, we're still watching the reruns of them 40 odd years later.
And amazingly, Match Game was canceled right off the bat. And so all the show's writers said, we don't care, you know, let's throw caution to the wind and let's make this show hilarious and throw double entendres. And that's what made the show explode with popularity, right?
Well, yeah. Well, Dick DiBartolo, who was longtime writer for Mad Magazine and is a great guy, absolutely a doll, he was really the exclusive or primary writer in the 60s. And that was when initially the show was canceled and then brought, you know, basically it never left. I mean, they were just, you know, on the chopping block. And Dick had gone to Mark Goodson and said, look, Mark, can I throw in some jazzier Q&As and we'll kind of lighten it up a bit? And Mark basically said, the show is canceled, you know, why not have fun? And during that time, all of a sudden, the audiences started tuning in and the 60s version of Match Game was allowed to continue. But it was not nearly as funny as the 70s version. When Match Game 73 premiered, it was a totally reconfigured format. Instead of just two celebrity captains, they would basically now have a six celebrity panel. And, you know, the set was designed for a lot of banter and the interaction between Gene and the celebrities. And frankly, the banter would end up kind of taking over and, you know, the game became kind of a secondary thing.
Mm-hmm. And Gene Rainbury, the show's host, his background was in radio. And I think he was in Bye Bye Birdie in the original Broadway production.
Yes, he did Broadway shows, Bye Bye Birdie, and that's where he initially met Charles Nelson Reilly, because Charles Nelson Reilly was in the show. And so Brett Summers, who was married to Jack Klugman, mm-hmm. and Charles had met on a flight sometime around then, late 60s. They just hit it off and they just became friendly, but they didn't see each other until the third week of Match Game. When Match Game 73 premiered, basically Dick DiBartolo was brought back in to be a writer, but because he was still remaining in New York, where he was working for Mad Magazine and he was perfectly happy to live there, he sent in questions, but they got in some additional writers on the West Coast that would just kind of help, you know, flesh out everything. So they had plenty of very funny questions, fill in the blank questions that they now used, featuring a host of characters like Dumb Dora and all these other characters. And Elliot Feldman, R. Patrick Neary, and a few of the other writers just sort of helped fill in the gaps when Dick, you know, was working on other projects. He would send in a weekly series of questions that he had written up, and they would just kind of, you know, fiddle around, figure out which ones were going to work best on air. And Gene, because he was such a gifted improv guy, he would basically gauge how the game was going. You know, basically, was the situation such that we needed an easy question for this particular contestant, or is the game going a little too fast, so maybe we need to stump some people? So they would base the question that they chose on, you know, did we need an easy one? Mm. Did we need a harder one? And that's where the comedy writing of these writers really came into play, because they also had to come up with questions that would allow for easy, you know, everybody knows what the answer is to this one. Mm-hmm. And then some of them where there could be, you know, a million different answers and you needed to kind of shake things up.
Now, did the panels know the questions ahead of time? Because I know, like, on Hollywood Squares, they used to give the people the answer ahead of time so that they could answer the question funny. But then they're like, oh, we can't do that anymore. And the show kind of went stale. And I think it was Paul Lynn was just like, you have to give us the questions ahead of time so that we can come up with something funny. Was that the case for the match game?
It was not. And the reason was because Mark Goodson and Bill Todman, who had weathered the scandals of the quiz show scandals of the late 50s and early 60s, were very adamant about following the FCC or whatever the network guidelines were. They had witnessed how other game show producers basically, you know, were ruined by the quiz show scandals. Mm. Goodson Todman survived easily because really a lot of their game shows were not hard intellectual kind of, you know, they weren't doing Jeopardy or something like that, mm-hmm. where you had to have where there was quote unquote a correct answer. A lot of their shows, To Tell the Truth and I've Got a Secret and Match Game, the action pretty much happened on stage, you know, in front of the cameras.
But in terms of like the scene at the time, like it feels like all the celebrities wound up either being on this or Love American Style or The Love Boat, you know, like ensemble kind of shows. And part of that is because a lot of them work together on Broadway in New York City. And so when everybody started moving to California, they already had this baked in relationship.
Yeah. I mean, that really was how a lot of people got work at that time, because they knew each other, they worked with each other, and they knew how well they worked with each other. They knew what each other's temperament was. They knew what the other person could do. And a lot of times, because they already had built-in chemistry, that's why so many of these shows like The Love Boat would just pop. You know, you would have Gene Rayburn and Brett Summers do a guest shot on The Love Boat, or Fanny Flagg. Mm. I think there was one where Fanny and Gene were kind of having a love interest in the storyline of the show, of that particular episode. And it was very funny because, you know, the television audience knew they worked together on Match Game. Mm. And they already had this built-in rapport. So it just kind of added a little kind of wink-wink inside joke that even the television viewing audience could pick up on and kind of feel like sort of, you know, they were part of the in crowd because they knew some sort of backstory.
And Ashley, you were telling me that shows like Match Game not only pioneered this type of cheeky double entendre sense of humor that so much television is, you know, abundant in these days, but it also was a way for gay and LGBT people to become familiarized with American audiences. And someone like, you know, Paul Lynde, certainly with Hollywood Squares, or Charles Nelson Reilly, you know, audiences understood to some degree that these were gay men, and, you know, they're certainly not going to be the marrying type.
Oh, yes. Well, the one thing about game shows that people don't really realize, it's kind of a subversive thing, because, you know, a game show format, especially a comedic oriented one, was so non-threatening. And so basically shows like Match Game and Hollywood Squares and a few of the others could basically introduce these really red hot topics into Midwestern, middle American living rooms in a very, you know, couched in these very comedic fill in the blank questions and answers. And it was a very non-threatening kind of thing, but you could talk about issues of feminism and civil rights and gay rights. And it wasn't hard hitting. Nobody was having an in-depth discussion about, you know, changing the world. But at the same time, it kind of made these subjects a little bit more palatable because they were introduced in a very non-threatening and a very funny way. And of course, Charles was about as out on television as you could get. Same with Paul Lynde. You know, Charles would occasionally make a reference to it, but it was something where I had early on interviewed Peter Marshall, who hosted the original Hollywood Squares. And I asked him, how did you guys get away with all this double entendre and all this, you know, really racy stuff? And he basically said, well, you know, if you got it, you got it. If you didn't get it, it just went over your head. But if you got it, you thought, that's absolutely great. That's so clever. That's so witty. And that's why the audiences kept coming back for more.
Well, I'll tell you this, like, for what we do on the internet to this day, there is a lot of censorship. For example, if you write very candidly about sexuality on your blog, Google and other advertising and search engines will downplay your content because advertisers don't want to tie their brand or their ad to what you do. And so the way we subvert it is by relying on that same sensibility of the double entendre. So, you know, a search engine's not going to get what you're talking about, but the audience who's listening at home, who is capable of understanding, will understand it very, very well. And to me, it's a very high way It's a very advanced
code.
Way of thinking.
You know,
yeah.
You have to speak in code, and that's what queer people have always done. You have to work around these kinds of things. But, I remember being a small child watching, Hollywood Squares with Paul Lynn, and he'd say something funny, and my mother would laugh, and the audience would laugh, and I wouldn't get it. I'd be so mad because I'm like, what is he saying? And my mother was just like, oh, it's just a joke. You wouldn't understand or something like that. And I was just, I was so annoyed.
Who's generally better looking, a fairy or a pixie?
Looks aren't everything.
Anything bring tears to a monkey's eyes?
Learning that Tarzan swings both ways.
Now, Charles Nelson Reilly, he was in a weirdest career track imaginable because he moves to California in I guess this is in the late 60s, and in 1971, he gets cast in a Sid and Marty Krofft TV show, Lidsville, playing Hoodoo, a green-skinned magician who's very much a derivative character of the Wicked Witch from The Wizard of Oz, in a world
where
Butch Patrick from The Munsters is whisked away and every living creature is a hat. Like it's a psychedelic trip.
What happened?
The damn good hat sock it to you again?
Oh, you have a big mouth for a little hood, so keep it shut.
Let's go back and get them, boss. We'll break their brims.
Yeah, we'll split their seams.
We'll knock their brains out.
Knock their brains out. Knock their brains out.
Oh.
Knock their brains out. Why, that's it. I have just come up with the most fantastic idea.
Oh, boy, what is it, boss?
I have just come up with an idea to end my trouble with the good hats forever. Stand aside, everybody. This is not going to be easy. Here goes! Oh, there it is, my little dumpling. The most evil device ever conceived.
The cowboy hat and all these, the characters, that show was crazy. I mean, Sid and Marty Krofft had done a lot of crazy shows. Lidsville's probably the funniest one. And whenever you mentioned it to Charles, he would just give you a look like, how the hell do you know that? Because even he had forgotten about half the stuff that he'd done on his resume. And that was one of the crazier ones. He'd enjoyed the show. The one thing about Charles, he really, I had a lot of conversations with him. He loved and respected the people with whom he worked. On Lidsville, the one thing he hated about it was the makeup, because he had that green makeup and he had this kind of facial prosthetic, hair and wig and mustache and whatever. He hated that stuff because, of course, the glue and all that stuff irritates your skin. But I quote him in the book. He was talking about one time when he was having lunch in some restaurant and he was talking. And all of a sudden, this little girl came over to his table and said, "Are you the hoodoo?" and he just turned around and without a beat said, "I'm not the hoodoo, I'm the great hoodoo." And I can't do a decent Charles Nelson Reilly impression. But I mean, he just all of a sudden just went into this character. And, this little girl was raptured by this. And of course, he had such a distinctive voice and such a distinctive manner. And the thing about Charles and Brett, these people were exactly in life what you saw on screen. I will say this about game shows, and I think one of the reasons that shows like these were so popular is that before, quote unquote, reality television, you would see something like maybe The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson or a few of the other talk shows like Dick Cavett and Merv Griffin. And the other thing would be game shows. And you would see these people in their most natural state because unlike any drama or sitcom in which they know their lines, hit their marks, they're portraying a character, on a game show, there's no way to fake it. You are going to be either as witty or as nitwitty as you actually are, and there is no way you can fake it. Your response, you're either going to have a good, easygoing temperament, or if you're a very rigid person or not a very nice person, it's going to come across.
And so none of the contestants, none of the celebrities were given any material. They just were winging it on the spot on Match Game?
Totally.
So it's just like the Rue Girls on Snatch Game. I imagine you're familiar with watching RuPaul's parody of the Match Game.
Yes, the Snatch Game.
Just like Match Game, it's very great opportunity to get to know the comedic capabilities of all the contestants. And, thrown on top of that, they're also given the challenge to impersonate a established entertainer or celebrity.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's part of the fun.
So that's where it gets tricky then, and different from the Match Game, because Match Game, you're presenting as yourself, but Snatch Game, you're presenting as somebody else, and you have to be as funny as that person is.
And usually, they fall
Match
flat
Game,
on their
of
face.
Course, was a real game. You know, the Snatch Game is more of an excuse to showcase them rather than try to actually win contestants' money.
Mm. But what do you make of, like, I'm sure you've watched RuPaul's Drag Race Snatch Game, and I imagine, like, what do you make of this? Because right now, I believe Snatch Game's been on the air longer than Match Game 73 in iteration was, which was, I believe,
73 to 79. Is that right?
Yeah, was it 6 years or 9 years?
It was, well, 73 through technically like 79, but then the show was in syndication, so it basically went on through 82.
But in terms of original shows like RuPaul's Drag Race Now, has gone longer than the Match Game that it parodies.
So there's probably 10 episodes of Snatch Game, and there are probably hundreds,
seasons,
if not thousands. No,
oh,
there's 10
I see,
episodes
I see.
Of
yeah,
Snatch
yeah,
Game.
Yeah, that makes
and
sense.
And there's
yeah.
thousands of episodes of Match Game.
But actually, like, what do you make of it? Like, I'm sure you have an opinion about it.
Oh, I mean, it's fun, but they're a totally different animal. I mean, it's something where it's just pure entertainment. Of course, watching RuPaul's Drag Race, watching the Snatch Game on there, they can say anything and they'll still try to be witty about it and fun, but they can get away with saying anything. Whereas, you know, watching something like Match Game, they specifically had to speak in code and speak, you know, in double entendre because, you know, the censors wouldn't allow it. There were a few episodes where, you know, they censored like Marsha Wallace, or they censored Joyce Bulafont, and there was a great big oops, and you heard the slide whistle sound, and you sat there in the television, you know, in the living room, wondering what the hell somebody just said on television, and you wouldn't ever know it. Whereas, you know, today on RuPaul's show, you can say pretty much anything.
So was it Marsha Wallace who got into trouble first for saying genitalia, or was it the boobies?
Yes.
Answer.
No. She said genitalia, but she thought, oh, I'm going. The question was something like, unlucky Louis was so unlucky because his whatever was, you know, smaller or whatever. Obviously, the answer was supposed to be something suggesting genitalia. But of course, this was family television. It was daytime television. You couldn't say overt things. So people were saying nose, ear, eye, whatever. And Marsha just thought, you know, this is silly. I'm sick of all this, you know, pussyfooting around. She thought, I know, I'll answer medically. If I use a medical term, they can't, you know, have a problem with that. So she wrote genitalia, and then she showed it to Dickie Dawson, who was sitting next to her, and he just kind of blanched when he saw what she wrote on the card. And she just thought, oh, how odd. And then Jean came to her and she held up the card, and all of a sudden bells and whistles, and they stopped everything. And Ira Scutch, who produced the show, came over to her. Ira was basically the one who was the judge on the show. He was the one just off the cameras who basically gave the thumbs up or the thumbs down whether something was a matching answer. And basically Ira just said to Marsha, you get one.
What was
the consequence if the celebrity panel broke the rules?
Well, most of the time they didn't. You know, all these people pretty much knew the rules and pretty much followed them. Marsha genuinely was shocked. She had no idea that genitalia would offend anyone. She thought it was a technical term, so therefore non-offensive.
And your book, in the book, you mentioned that they actually had their own codes for certain words. Like, you couldn't say urinate, you had to say tinkle. You couldn't say get laid,
had to make love.
So you had like these different things that you could say.
Or make whoopee, which was the other big one. Mm-hmm. You say tinkle, instead of urinate. You say all these euphemisms. And, you know, some of the people like Jack Klugman just kind of, you'll basically said, you know, poo-pooed the show because he basically felt like, well, it's just silly because it's all baby talk. Mm. He preferred word games and really intellectual games like password and things like that, which he did all the time.
Sure. I mean, it was a cocktail party in many ways, right?
It really was. It really was.
Well, the contestants on the show said they're given cocktails and they're openly smoking. And in one episode, he spills his drink and he says, let me get every last drop of this vodka. And he squeezes the napkin into his mouth as if it's a shot.
Oh, of course, because that was the humor at that time. It was a very adult, you know, Playboy Club kind of humor.
But were the producers actually boozing up the celebrities or were they very professional about it?
This is the thing. Much has been made about the drinking. I know the current version of Match Game hosted by Alec Baldwin, you know, as soon as that show started, they basically, you know, were grilling all the celebrities saying, you know, okay, how much booze is going on behind the sets? And apparently every time you walked into the green room, they would hand you, you know, some 80 proof something or other in the new version. The old version, everybody did drink. They would have the occasional glass of wine or cocktail with lunch during the luncheon break because they would shoot during the course of a single day, 5 episodes or 6 once they had Match Game PM installed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they'd have a few drinks and they'd get a little lighter. You could definitely tell which shows were the Thursday and Friday episodes. But I think a lot of people have made a little too much about that, basically suggesting that all the humor came from the booze. Mm. And the thing is, you know, I kind of take that personally because these people really were brilliant and they really were talented. And I don't want people to think that the humor came from, you know, a bottle of tequila. However, yes, they did drink, but they never got blotto. And the other reason they didn't, you know, they played up the drinking, but they didn't. There were a few episodes where you can tell they had a couple extra. But most of the time, nobody wanted to get drunk on the show because at that time, there were only a handful of networks on television. You didn't want to be seen as kind of a loose cannon. You had to know that, you know, if you really were slurring your words, if you were really making a spectacle of yourself, you wouldn't ever work again in the business because people would just think, oh, you know, this person's a lush. But everybody played up the drinking. You know, Foster Brooks, who was a brilliant comedian throughout the 60s and 70s, he always played the drunk. But the thing was, during that entire period, he was, oh, playing the drunk and, you know, kind of slurring his words and doing all this stuff. He was actually in AA. He hadn't touched a drop of alcohol in years.
Really? I didn't know that. And that's amazing.
And that was the same thing with, like, Dean Martin. Dean Martin was always on stage in Vegas, you know, carrying a glass of something that was probably Coca-Cola or ginger ale, and he was talking about drinking. He didn't take up drinking till after he, you know, left Vegas.
So how influential was Match Game to other television shows at that time? Because, you know, the Dean Martin Celebrity Roast, which also played up that same kind of atmosphere, started a year later. And it seems like just everybody was drunk and pretending to, you know, have a party.
Well, that was pretty much that Johnny Carson sensibility. It was the evening programs, you could get away with a lot more sophisticated humor and sophisticated atmosphere. What Match Game did was it brought that kind of late night sensibility into daytime. And that's one reason why Match Game pioneered, you know, words like boobs and tinkle being heard on daytime television, because nobody, you know, during the day, they at that point had either very pedestrian game shows or they had soap operas, which might have their own little, you know, intrigues and innuendos, but there was nothing terribly overt. What Match Game basically brought was the Tonight Show during the day, you know, brought it into, you know, 12 noon or at one point they got moved to, you know, the afternoons. And
wasn't Johnny Carson an announcer on Match Game early on?
What?
No, but Gene Rayburn had actually been co-host on The Tonight Show when Steve Allen was on it. Mm. When it had, was that the first version or the second version? And I think Johnny Carson was the third version, the third host.
I see.
Of The Tonight Show.
Yeah, because it was a Jack Parr in there.
So there
too,
was
right?
a Tonight Show.
So there was a lot of movement these kind of Las Vegas cocktail drinking, chain smoking, gravelly voiced Broadway, you know, media personalities.
Oh, yeah. And that was what that era was. Orson Bean had told me that actors and actresses of that era were bred to be raconteurs. You know, they were all gifted storytellers. Today, a lot of actors and actresses may be very pretty and very handsome, but a lot of times they're not really great personalities for telling spontaneous stories mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. They get on a talk show just to plug their latest project, and then quick, we have to go to commercial. That lasts 5 minutes, and then you get back to the celebrity doing some silly game, and that's about it.
Oh, which reminds me, we need a cut to a break. So we'll be right back.
Okay.
Safeguard's deodorant lather is so effective, it doesn't need heavy perfume. Safeguard gives you naturally clean-smelling skin.
He always smells so fresh.
What about me? I use a deodorant soap.
That's just it, Jeffrey. You smell like a deodorant soap.
You know, it's a pleasure having someone in my cab who smells so fresh and clean. You married?
Safeguard doesn't need heavy perfume to mask odor because it's so effective at removing the cause of perspiration odor.
Great.
Good morning.
Good morning. He smells just the way a man should smell. Clean.
Safeguard's deodorant lather is so effective, it doesn't need heavy perfume. With Safeguard, you don't get the heavy smell of some deodorant soaps. You get naturally clean-smelling skin.
Oh, we've gone bananas for Big Banana in crayon. You'll learn to write a lot of ways. Oh, we've gone bananas for Big Banana in crayon. The colors are so bright and gay. Oh, you can learn to color, write smooth lines or fat. Draw a banana and give it a hat. Okay, bunch, you'll go bananas for Big Banana in crayon. You'll learn to write a lot of ways.
No, but you're right. The actors, you know, back in the day, they would tell stories on these talk shows. And you're right. They really don't do that too much anymore. Except I think
well, they
the
were
one
all
exception,
gifted at improv and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Charles had done The Tonight Show something like 96 or 97 times. Mm. And he didn't live terribly far from the studio. So they had an arrangement because he was an old friend of Johnny Carson's. Whenever some celebrity, you know, couldn't make it. The guest is sick or something mm-hmm. like that. They'd call Charles or they'd call a couple of other celebrities to come in last minute to fill in. And Charles, even if he didn't have a film or a TV show to plug, he would just show up mm-hmm. and he would start reciting Shakespeare or he'd go into some long monologue about, you know, oh, how he was nursing a hangover or he'd make some big joke. And he was wonderful because he was such a gifted storyteller and such a really gifted comedic person.
Mm. And people know him from the game shows mostly, but you know, he was a very well-respected theater director and had been nominated for how many Tonys?
I don't even know off the top of my head, but I know that he had worked a long time. How many?
Many. There were many, right?
There were many. Yeah. He was nominated for many. He had also won the Emmy when he, as an actor, guest starred on The X-Files.
I just watched that in preparing for this,
and he was
too.
So good on it.
Yeah, and Alex Trebek, rest in peace, was also on that same episode.
That's right. It's been a long time since I've watched
The
X-Files.
It's Game Show Week here on Feast of Fun.
Yeah, we're doing our
It just happened to be this way.
Well, we have a lot of amazing shows this week. Yesterday, we had, of course, the lovely Sherry Vine. Talking about Supermarket Sweep. Did you get to catch that?
No, I didn't get it, but I didn't get a chance to watch it, but I knew that Sherry and Jackie Beat were both appearing on the show, mm-hmm. And Jackie, I know because Jackie Beat always appears on the Mismatch Game, which is a, you know, maybe like three times a year, four times a year fundraiser that they do at Los Angeles's LGBTQ Center as kind of a fundraiser event. They do a parody of Match Game, kind of along the lines of RuPaul's Snatch Game. And Dennis Hensley hosts it. The first time they had done it, Marsha Wallace was a special guest, celebrity panelist.
And for people who are not familiar with Marsha Wallace, she does the voice Edna Krabappel, rest in peace, on The Simpsons.
She was a
Mrs. Krabappel.
You give me fever when you touch me, fever when you hold me tight. Fever! Ha!
Kill me.
And from the Bob Newhart Show.
Oh, she was
show.
Fabulous. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Carol Kester on the Newhart Show.
Mm-hmm. And so that event at the LGBT Community Center, it must be just a blast.
Oh, it is. It's great. They get a lot of local comedians who are very talented. Jackie Beat is one of them, Nadia Ginsburg, and a number of others. And, you know, they donate their time to help raise money for, you know, the LGBT Center, which does a lot of great work. And, you know, the fact that they're doing a parody of Match Game was a no-brainer. I've donated copies of Match Game 101 to give as prizes. And, you know, Jackie posed with the book and for some publicity photos and that sort of thing. It was a lot of fun.
One thing I found interesting in reading your book and is discovering that Charles Nelson Reilly was friends with Burt Reynolds for like 46 years. That's a
they were best friends.
Interesting relationship, because you always think of, you know, Charles as kind of, you know, this queenie guy, and do you think of the other one as very like this
Burt
masculine
Reynolds.
Burt Reynolds is this masculine butch guy.
Right, right. Well, and Burt was also from the South. You know, he was from Florida, and he, you know, had this very masculine and one would assume homophobic or misogynistic attitude, and he wasn't that way at all. He was friends with a lot of gay men. You know, Dom DeLuise was a close friend, Charles Nelson Reilly, and...
You just outed Dom DeLuise?
I
he never well, came I, out. I he, might he was actually married with kids.
That's
he?
Right. Well,
I always say that Dom DeLuise is very gay, and you know, and certainly, like, you know, folks in your scene in Los Angeles understood that he what you know was in the closet throughout his life, and in the grave he sternly did not come out. But you know, he was understood by the LGBT scene and. Especially in comedy and in acting in Los Angeles, to be gay.
I mean, next thing you know, I might be outing James Coco or something. But,
well, you even had Rip Taylor on Match Game too. Like, you had these, like, and we call them the legends of gay voices that later on in their careers were part of the, like the Hanna-Barbera cartoons. And so when
we think
of camp culture, it's kind of hard to just, you know, separate, you know, Paul Lynn's snarky demeanor or Charles Nelson Reilly's, you know, voices,
well,
which are so much of a part
so
of our
cartoon. Talented.
Yeah.
And they were, of course, so over the top.
Charles Nelson
and
Reilly.
Part of that was the showbiz thing. If you were a queenie guy, the only way you were going to make it in showbiz is by being so over the top. You know, if you were trying to pass, you were never going to pass. Sissy boys were never going to pass. So they'd have to embrace the, you know, Truman Capote thing of just simply shrugging and, you know, not even bothering to pretend they were straight. They would just simply be their own celebrated personalities and just be so over the top that people were too busy laughing to stop and think, gee, I wonder if he's married. Or,
but it,
gee, I wonder why
he's never
married.
It seems like they cultivated their personalities much like a writer would cultivate their writing style.
They did. They did. And part of that was also the era. People understood, I guess, branding is the way to put it. They understood how to have a trademark quality, a particular laugh. You know, Charles Nelson Reilly had his nasal laugh that I cannot possibly replicate.
Well, he did
Paul
this.
Lynn
it, like, I've done it a couple times in the
quality.
Show. You know, and Rip Taylor would always throw confetti whenever he entered.
Oh, yes, of course. And he would have his little giggle that was a very, you know, show busy kind of, you know. And
it's so much fun, they were fun to look they were back fun guys on these guys fondly, but they also lived very complicated, tortured lives. And towards the end of his life, Charles Nelson Reilly did a one-man show where he sort of chronicled his rise and fall in show business. Did you ever get a chance to catch that?
I did. I did. Oh. I saw it. I was taken on my birthday, May 21st of 2002, to the Cannon Theater in Beverly Hills. A friend of mine, the very friend of mine who had inspired John Schultz, who had inspired me to, you know, work on the Match Game book, took me to see the show. And it was wonderful because Charles on stage was utterly brilliant. The show was later taped and then released on DVD. It is available today. And if people have not seen Save It for the Stage, The Life of Reilly, I highly recommend they look it up because it's like 3 hours of Charles Nelson Reilly being utterly brilliant and very touching.
I have some sad news that he one of the last interview requests he granted, I think, was this podcast in its early days. And unfortunately, we had been making plans. I may believe it was with his personal assistant, and he passed away before we were able to tape it. Like, he suddenly got very sick, and then he just died, you know?
Yeah. No, he'd had pneumonia, and then he'd been ill for about a year and a half.
But this is a person who genuinely loved to talk and connect with people. And he...
Oh, he did.
And you know, he was... I think that stemmed from
He thought of himself as a teacher.
A teacher, yeah. And I think that's what made him such an extraordinary human being and such a presence on that show.
Well, and I think he was most proud of being a teacher as well as a director. He had written librettos for opera. He had done all this stuff. And he very much, he didn't resent Match Game per se. He resented the fact that he knew when the obituaries happen, I will be seen as, you know, game show fixture dies rather than talented actor, talented director, talented librettist, talented, you know, he felt that the game shows limited him, but at the same time, he was always quick to say how much he loved the people he worked with. He always had a great time. He and Brett and Fanny and Everly Scott and the others who worked on the show remained friends literally until, you know, their passings.
You mentioned in your book that a few of the other contestants or panelists felt like their agents were like, don't do so many game shows. You're going to get typecast. Oh, yeah. It's going to be very limiting. But many of them just said, I love it. And it's fun.
Yeah. And there were a number of them who had, you know, worked enough. Betty White could do absolutely all the game shows she wanted. And because she was married to Alan Ludden, host of Password, she kind of got a free, you know, free pass. So she could be viewed as both an actress and a game show personality. But a lot of them, like Charles, you know, felt like, well, you know, I'm seen as just a game show personality. Joyce Beulafont had done the shows and she absolutely loved doing them. But her agent told her, you know, you're becoming more of a personality and less of an actress. And she finally ended up deciding, you know, I'm just going to keep doing the game shows. And her agent shrugged and said, okay, that's fine. That's your choice. But understand what's happening. And Joyce probably did not have as strong an acting career as she might otherwise have. Although, you know, she was on the Mary Tyler Moore Show and she was in Airplanes. So, you know, not exactly a small, unheard of movie. So
now one celebrity panelist that everybody loved and all the contestants relied on his wit and wisdom was Richard Dawson, who was from being on Hogan's Heroes. And as the show grew in popularity, the producers gave him, you know, the job also of hosting Family Feud. And that's when all hell broke loose. Like, Richard Dawson And you know, maybe you can illuminate this. Did he become like insufferable to work with? Like I read that he wore sunglasses for a week.
That was the final week. And allegedly it was because he had some sort of an accident. He scratched his eye or something like that. But he was very definitely during that period taciturn. But it was really, you know, he had done Match
Game. Do you buy Richard Dawson's sunglass excuse?
Well, it definitely cut him off from the audience and the other panelists. Yeah.
But it's like mentally he had already quit the show and he was just there in person.
Yeah. Well, at that point, I mean, he'd been doing Match Game for like 5 years, six years. And he, you know, he was tired of it. And obviously he had more, you know, authority on Family Feud, where he was the sole host. He wasn't one of an ensemble panel. It's difficult to go between the two. You know, there have been a number of, you know, stories about Richard's attitude during that period. But I will say this. Everybody that I spoke to, without exception, was very quick to point out that Richard was the most gifted panelist on the show. He had a knack for being able to read the contestants and read what their most likely answers were going to be. So he always matched them. He genuinely cared about the contestants winning money. Even Brett Summers, who was not somebody to hold back any punches, was the first person to say that Richard, you know, they didn't exactly get along. They weren't exactly each other's cup of tea, but she was the first person to say he was the best game player. He was a brilliant guy. He really cared about the contestants winning, and she very much respected that. But they had a few periods where they were not, you know, necessarily talking, and you'd see the snarky, you know, banter between them.
And Brett the Summers one thing, and though, Richard Dawson weren't that were mean. Both very concerned with the well-being of the contestants. And in fact, the Match Game is known for having the most awkward game show contestant in history of Evie Phineas. And you can watch this on YouTube.
And you mention her in the book, but you don't name her by name. She's the one who says, like, I'm going to buy, what are you going to do with this $50? I'm going to buy a house. I'm going to buy a car. And it's because she kept on kind of like winning or something. And she didn't expect it to happen. She didn't expect it. She got nervous. She didn't know what to do with her.
She kept saying, like, can I go home now?
And, like, there was just so much charm
there. Was she was very nervous. And most of the time people, you know, because they would, you know, test the contestants beforehand and, you know, they'd, you know, make sure that they were comfortable enough with, you know, the idea of the game before they actually went out on stage. But the thing is, when that turntable turns around and all of a sudden you've got lights and an audience in front of you, it definitely, you know, is an unexpected moment. You will get that deer caught in the headlights look. And then hopefully everybody would snap to attention and be able to play the game and not kind of lose their mind. But there were a few people who, you know, definitely were very, got a little bit of stage fright. They were kind of overwhelmed by the whole thing.
Because the process for the contestants is they sat them down on a giant spinning platform and the backstage area is completely dark, and all of a sudden they spin them around. It's like lights, camera, celebrities, and action.
Well, yeah, that's getting turned around there. The panel of this of the stars is coming from the other direction, so it's just there's a lot going
on. It's a moving set.
In that thing, and I'm like, I'm watching that happen. I'm like, I bet they trademarked all of that. I bet you those all like you can't do that on a television show without having to pay them some kind of copyright. I'm sure.
I wouldn't want to try, but I don't have that kind of money. But no, the show looked fabulous with the streamer lights, and it was a happy set. You know, it's bright orange and shag carpeting, and then this kind of cream and royal blue, you know, for the panel itself. But you know, you have bright orange and streamer lights.
And I mean,
how could you not be just
all the fashion that they all wear is just so incredible. I mean, Richard Dawson, it's hard for us to think about him now as a sex symbol, but he was kind of brought on because he was smart and sexy. And I'm looking at his clothes, and I'm just like, oh my God, I want that outfit. I want that light blue turtleneck and that purple velvet jacket. And then every t-shirt that Fanny Farmer has, like she's got like this thing that she looks like super Ronald McDonald. You're like, where do I get these outfits?
Oh, those t-shirts were fabulous. Mm-hmm. And of course, the most famous one is the fried eggs, you know, the two fried eggs on the front. even Brett talked about that one years later. Mm. And later Fanny donated those to charity. And I guess they auctioned them off to raise money. So someone out there has those. And, you know, they're worth a pretty penny today, I should think.
Why wasn't Mae West a contestant on the show? I'm sorry, a celebrity panelist.
Back in the 60s, one of the things Dick DiBartolo had told me, when they started the show, basically, you know, this was an excuse for all the kids to be, you know, running to, you know, call every celebrity they ever wanted to meet to come on the show. And that's, of course, everybody was fascinated by Mae West. She'd been the biggest star of one of the biggest stars of the 30s and 40s. And so many of the people who worked on the show for Goodson Todman Productions in the early 60s had grown up during that period. Mm-hmm. So they basically made a list of all the celebrities they ever wanted to meet. And some of them said yes and came on. And some of them, you know, didn't. Mae West, they kept calling. And finally, her rep called them and said, okay, look, I've got a level with you guys. Mae West is never going to do your show. And the reason is because she is blind as a bat and is too vain to wear eyeglasses. She would have to walk across the stage in order to go sit, and she would have to write down her answers. And because of her eyesight, she just will not do the show.
Oh, how fascinating. And
they were very disappointed by that. But it also gives you an idea of Mae West, because when she was doing movies like Myra Breckinridge and what was the other one?
Sextet.
She did in the same period. That's right. Sextet came later in like 77, 78. Mm. And she basically made sure she knew her lines. She hit her marks. She knew where she was supposed to go. But that was all a controlled atmosphere where she wasn't going to, you know, make a fool of herself and run into anything. Of course, making a fool of yourself when you're appearing in Sextet might be redundant. But
she had a musical number, you know, and that was very important to Mae West. She wouldn't do a show unless she had a musical number.
She needed to sing.
She had to sing.
Twist and Shout. I mean, come on. Mae West singing Twist and Shout. You're gonna say no to that?
Jane Mansfield was also a celebrity guest on the show.
On the first
That's right. She did it numerous times.
Yeah. She died numerous times. Not afterwards.
Yeah, of course, of course. She and Gene knew each other because they worked on Broadway. He was in Bye Bye Birdie, and she was in Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter with Orson Bean. And Jane and Orson came on the show on Match Game together, and then they both did it separately as well. Gene Rayburn actually became good friends with Jane Mansfield. Mm. And, of course, she was, you know, this gorgeous blonde bombshell, but she was also very intelligent, which is something that, you know, kind of went against the image, but she actually was a very highly intelligent woman, and she was a good game player.
Well, weren't all those blonde bombshells really intelligent? Like, you know, even
Marilyn Monroe,
Jane Mansfield,
Mae West.
Yeah. Well, Mae West had a different,
she was creative. She was a writer, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah, she had started in playwriting, and, you know, obviously to showcase herself, she wrote all her own plays. She was highly intelligent. Marilyn, I'm not quite sure if she was viewed as quote-unquote intelligent, but she certainly tried to better herself. She was not particularly well-educated, and later on she, you know, because she'd started as a model and then segued into acting, she wanted to become a serious actress. So she later studied at the Actors Studio in New York. And she really was reading up on a lot of playwrights, Chekhov and, you know, loftier subjects, because she really wanted to improve herself. I think that's kind of the difference between that era and today. People today don't necessarily try to polish themselves on intellectual matters and intellectual subjects the way they did back then.
Ashley, do you feel that the magic or the chemistry of the 1970s version of the Match Game has been able to be replicated? Because I feel like it hasn't. Even RuPaul's version is sort of a ghostly, pale specter of that robust, charming show.
Well, there are two factors going into that. One is, you know, Match Game, the 70s version of Match Game, was done on a daily basis. You know, you would tape five episodes per week or six with the PM version. And so you had time to really cultivate an atmosphere and a chemistry between the panelists. Whereas today's version, because it only airs once a week, and, you know, RuPaul's show, it's the same thing, and there's a rotating cast, they don't really get a chance to kind of build the same chemistry as they did back in the 70s. And the other thing is,
but even
because
Alec
today,
Baldwin couldn't do it, you know?
Well, and the other thing is, because today you can say just pretty much anything on television, you don't rely so much on wit as you did back then. There may be very highly intelligent people who are playing these games, but they're just not necessarily utilizing the real wit and double entendre, because they can say anything, you know, just some balls out answer today, that in the 70s they had to couch everything in euphemism. And
it was that tension that drove audiences
restraint
to watch.
Yeah, because the audiences knew what everybody was thinking. Whereas if you just flat out say what everybody is thinking, there's no mystery, you know?
So in order to recreate that charm, we have to make society more repressive.
Well, you know, in a roundabout kind of way, kind of.
I mean, that's,
at the very least, it's nice to have the option.
It is inspiring, the fact that, you know, regardless of how oppressive or regressive the world can get, that some magical moments like, you know, Match Game can arise from them. But really, Match Game came to light in the shadow as a consequence of the Nixon Watergate scandal. And certainly, if you're watching the show, they're always referencing Nixon. And what's interesting about the answers is that, like, if that show was played with the same questions today, the answers would be very different, because it very much is a time capsule of the world.
Yeah,
at
it's
that
the zeitgeist
time.
What's happening, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And also, they were talking about a lot of topical humor that made sense at that time. I have in my book, Match Game 101, in one of the chapters, I have a little mini glossary of some of the people and places and things that are referenced in some of the Q&As that people today might not necessarily know who they are, but people in the 70s certainly recognized who they were, because they were on, you know, commercials, or they were part of that era's pop culture.
What was up with that crazy, weird, long microphone that the host Gene Rayburn had? And he kept breaking it. Like, they would
he
cut.
Invented it.
Is
right?
Is that something he made?
I had heard that story. I never got the confirmation
I
on that.
It was in
I had
book.
Heard
Maybe
one
I'm
person
not.
Say.
But he kept breaking
so,
it.
Like, I probably,
it, like it, they would cut to commercial and then would come back, because we watched a bunch of these getting ready for the show. And he'd always be like, I'm like so drunk that I broke my microphone. Sorry, guys. Have a great day. And it was like such an awkward way to end a show.
No, of course. Well, and of course, that long telescopic microphone, because it could crunch down so that it would be smaller, but it could extend to that telescopic, very noteworthy length. And, you know, obviously that could be, you know, seen as something of a, you know, euphemism.
Unto I thought it was
itself.
Like a fairy wand. You know, part of it is like when you see it being used by Bob Barker in The Price is Right, you know, the point of that microphone becomes very obvious, whereas he doesn't have to physically get close to contestants, because when people they tend to grab the host and shake him. And imagine if you're taping day after day of these programs, it must be get exhausted to dealing with this. You know, they say the unwashed masses, the public.
Oh, I'm sure. The one thing about Match Game, Gene was able to stride between the two contestants off to the one side of the stage and then stride back over to the panelists. And it was always safer, of course, hanging out with the panelists. But, the configuration of the game allowed for a certain amount of distance, yet at the same time, a little bit of crossover so that you could give a little bit of attention to both sides. Bob Barker was kind of stuck in the middle of everything, and the camera was trained upon him at all times, so he had nowhere to go. He didn't have a moment of peace.
And Gene Rayburn, behind the scenes, was a very progressive-minded person and was very much in support or actively working to fund and advance LGBT liberation, civil rights, and abortion access for women with Planned Parenthood.
Well, he was very progressive-minded, and of course he knew people in show business, Charles Nelson Reilly, for example, who were gay, and he was perfectly comfortable with it because he was himself a red-blooded heterosexual man who was married and had a daughter, and he was secure enough with himself. He understood the world. He was a very, I guess, nice person in that regard. He didn't wish anybody ill. One of the things that he had told Ira Scutch, who directed Match Game in the 60s and then produced it in the 70s, he and Ira became very, very close. And basically, he had confessed to Ira that he had spent some time in psychoanalysis so that he could better guess possibly because of the war years he had served in the armed forces, or for other reasons, he had felt a great deal of anger that he wanted to get past.
It so seems like, when the show went off the air, like he, and I was reading interviews about him, and that he seemed like he very sad that the show was off the air, because for him, it was very much a very healthy social outlet. And this is what like a lot of people have talked about, like, for us, we've been doing this show for 16 years, and I remember reading about when Barbara Walters was retiring, that like when you end your talk show or your game show, that there's this overwhelming sense of sadness because it's so much of a part of your life for so long. And then when that goes away, you don't know what to do with yourself.
Well, yeah. And Gene, later, he would do some talk shows. They had a lot of, throughout the 90s, they had all sorts of talk shows. He would do the Howard Stern show. He would do Mary Lou Henner's show. He would do, Geraldo and all that kind of stuff. They would have the occasional game show themed week of episodes. And so he would be more than happy to come on and be reunited on camera with Brett or somebody like that and talk about how much he enjoyed the game shows and Match Game in particular. He had hosted a number of shows. But he really felt at his best with Match Game. And then after the 70s, into 80s version of Match Game ended, they came back a year later with a Match Game Hollywood Squares hour that lasted about 9 months and really just wasn't quite as good. There were some interesting elements in it, but some things are better in idea than actuality.
So it was like a KFC / Taco Bell.
Exactly. You don't get a specialized taco or burrito. You get this kind of hybrid with, some KFC mashed potatoes on the side, and you're like, what the hell is this? And that's kind of what watching that is. I think either Buzzer or the Game Show Network was rerunning the Match Game Hollywood Squares Hour. And pretty much the consensus was, oh, this is interesting. Oh, where's Brett? Where's Benny?
Ashley, are there any kind of game shows that you enjoy watching today, or anything on television that you feel like carries that same kind of spirit and camaraderie of the time?
I really don't think there's anything that's quite like this. I mean, there are other fun shows. I like Jeopardy, and I think it's a great show, but it's a totally different animal. Really, honestly, Match Game wasn't so much about the game as it was about the personalities of these fabulous people that you were basically going to the wildest cocktail party on television and getting to hang out with Fanny Flagg and getting to hang out with, you know, Deborah Lee Scott, and maybe Betty White would get up and do a little strip tease number to, you know, the stripper music, or maybe Brett would pretend she was sloshed and she'd get up and, you know, lie down on the floor on the shag carpeting, and Charles would come over and fan her, and, you know, they would write little notes to each other, and they would just be goofy and fun. And of course, Gene just went along with everything because he knew this was great TV. Mm. You know, this is why people are tuning in. They're not tuning in to watch somebody win, you know, a 75 Pinto. They're tuning in. That's great. God bless the people winning the 75 Pinto. But really, honestly, people are tuning in to see what are Brett and Charles going to do next? You know,
If you could travel back in time to being in that, you know, being a gay man in that world, would you have rather been a contestant or a celebrity panelist?
Well, let's face it, the celebrity panelists had more fun and were paid better. It's hard to say.
Do you think you could have survived as a gay man in that time period?
I don't know that I personally would have been able to pass in quite the same way as, say, a Rock Hudson type would have. So it might have been a little bit more of a self-conscious situation. Mm-hmm. Because I know Charles, for instance, he was in a long-term relationship. He and his partner, Patrick, met in, I think, like 85. So it was after the Match Game era. But it was perfectly possible to find happiness and live a quote-unquote open life at that time and still maintain a career. But you probably couldn't have been a sex symbol. You couldn't have been a Tom Cruise or possibly in this era, a Zac Efron, someone of that stature who has people, you know, slobbering after you and still come out as gay or lesbian or bi or whatever you happen to be.
Well, it seems like that you have to put out a book or capitalize on coming out. Like Zac Efron one day is going to come out as gay and put out a book.
You think?
Absolutely. If there's money to be made.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, you'd never know that he was coming out because he'd be throwing so many bros and dudes into everything he was saying that you would get lost in the middle of the conversation.
Did you see that next Netflix special that he did? Down to Earth. It was him and his daddy, his guru daddy, going around the world.
And just for the record, it was somebody he discovered by listening to him on his podcast.
Yeah.
And so if there's any celebrity, especially a hunky one, that wants to us to be his daddy guru and take us on an all-expensive paid trip to across the world mm-hmm. to get in touch with your inner spiritual self,
we're more than
happy to take that job.
You know, the fact that there are euphemisms such as that entire scenario, rather than people just simply saying, you know what, this guy's hot and he's got money, let's have a Jackie O kind of, you know, situation going on here. You can't really say that, I guess. So you have to say, oh, I'm traveling the world with my spiritual advisor. Okay. I mean,
that's what I call Mark.
Why not? Sure.
This is my spiritual advisor. He's really good for my psyche. So actually, it's a pleasure chatting with you. Your book is Match Game 101, A Backstage History of Match Game. Available where fabulous books are found.
Exactly.
It's being sold at Target.
It is at Target.com, Walmart.com, but I always tell people, please support the indie bookstores. Since you're in Chicago, the Unabridged bookstore on, what is it, Broadway or Clark carries it, Book Soup here in Los Angeles. You know, I always tell people, support the brick and mortar mom and pop shops.
Absolutely.
But you can get it, yes, at Target or Amazon or wherever. I've got a forthcoming book on the making of Breakfast at Tiffany's coming out in February.
Ooh.
In honor of that film's 60th anniversary.
Wow, has it been that long?
I know, yeah. I am currently at work on a book on the making of Mommy Dearest.
Oh, wow. Well, you'll have to come back. We'd love to talk to you about
I know, and talk about Breakfast at Tiffany's and gay stuff.
Yeah. I'd love to see them kind of like remake that, just because of like that just horrible representation of the Asian actor is just
that's
just
Mickey like, Rooney.
It's Mickey Rooney.
Yeah. Mickey Rooney. Like, yeah.
Why? I'm sure
it's I have
all
a full
in your
chapter
book.
Discussing that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Faye Dunaway says she's still to this day haunted by the ghost of Joan Crawford for doing that role.
Is that what
she said? That's what she said.
You know, if she,
I have friends who actually lived in the same
building
as her.
She could be like Patty Duke, really. Okay. If only she could be like someone like Patty Duke, who for a long time couldn't stand Valley of the Dolls and couldn't stand any reference to it, but finally came to, you know, just shrug it off and embrace the camp aspects of it and even learn to laugh about it. And she... It was kind of a healing thing for her. If only Faye Dunaway could do the same thing, because she took Mommy Dearest so seriously, of course, and yet it flopped so miserably in the critical reviews, such as they were, and she blames it forever after for having tainted her career, which, yeah, it did. But if only she could just kind of let go of that anger, let go of that resentment of it, and just see it for what it is. I mean, it's a camp classic. It's
well, you know, they made a sequel to Mommy Dearest.
They did?
Beyond the Valley of Mommy?
No, Supergirl. She plays exactly the same character as Selena in that movie.
Yeah, she chews so much scenery in that one, you'd think that she'd walked into the set out of, you know, the wire hangers scene. My gosh.
And she and who played Supergirl in that movie? Billie Jean.
Yes. What was her name? She was also in The Secret of My Success.
Yes, Helen Slater. So her
Helen Slater's
sister.
Christian Slater's sister. Both of them were fighting over some hunk in the movie. And basically the plot of Supergirl is Mommy Dearest, Faye Dunaway, trying to steal a man from Supergirl. And her lesbian lover, who's played
Brenda
Vaccaro, was like, what about me?
It's so terrible.
It's so bad. And then after that, she did Eva Perón in the made-for-TV movie of Evita.
Mm-hmm. And basically, she plays Mommy Dearest again.
And that was actually good. You know, NBC, you know, miniseries. You know, that was a prestige thing. Mm. But
you could edit
those
three films
together,
and you're not sure which one says, I'm not acting
over my dead body.
Like, you don't know which. You could play a game, which is like play audio clips from those three movies, and you have to identify which movie.
Gay men would all know Mommy Dearest.
Yes.
Quotes, though.
But you're not going to guess Evita, or you're not going to guess Supergirl as easily. Mm.
No. I mean, at least, well, her hair was totally different, and it was definitely, you know, a contemporary piece for Supergirl, at least in the Eva Perón miniseries, you know, that was still set in the 40s. So it was, you know, the look was kind of overlapping, sort of.
Ashley, where in Los Angeles are you located so people can stalk you?
I am in the Los Feliz neighborhood, or Los Feliz, depending.
You're close to Jackie and Mario Diaz and all those wonderful people.
Yes. Yes, and Mario, Hunky Mario. I was going to give you a fun fact about Faye Dunaway.
Ooh.
Among the other movie stars that she has portrayed, she played Mae West in this indie movie in 2008.
God.
Yes, if you want a real trip, get on YouTube right now and type in Faye Dunaway Mae West.
Girl.
And this film will come up. You'll get to see a couple of scenes, and it's Faye Dunaway as Mae.
Wow.
Faye as Mae.
Spend
it some time.
Oh, what is and it you do for a living?
I saw that movie when it came out.
Did you? Okay.
Yeah. But it's not denture wearing sextet Mae West. It's young, vibrant Mae West.
Well,
no, it's
semi vibrant. I mean, it's set in the like late 50s or early 60s. So she's not geriatric Mae West. She's not, you know, quite, you know, duking it out with Raquel Welch Mae West. And Faye Dunaway, you know, she looks good. They didn't pad her bust enough. I don't know why they did not, but, you know, she looks good. Just, you know, she's playing Mae West. She should be a little,
you know, I feel like somebody needs to do a book. And I wish that you would. Maybe you're all working on one about Mae West's later years, because there was one about the making of Myra Breckinridge. But it's all it touches very little on Mae West's final years of that movie and Sextet. And like even like interviews like the one that she did with Dick Cavett, which you can watch on YouTube. It's just such
a bizarre
life, you know, and so wonderfully charming and how, you know, out of touch, or maybe, you know, I'm not sure if like Mae West was aware of how wonderfully weird and ridiculous she came across, you know, as this, as this octogenarian sex symbol.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, she lived in this elegant old Art Deco building that she bought with her, you know, Paramount money early on. And so throughout her Hollywood years, she was living in this really attractive building in kind of the Hancock Park area of the city. And, you know, she lived this glamorous life with her, you know, kind of cream-colored French provincial furniture and her mirrored ceiling above her bed and her swan bed and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, we should all be able to just, you know, throw a lot of money around and just let our delusions run rampant. It's kind of like Elvis Presley's jungle room. I mean, I always thought if I was going to loon out as a celebrity, I would take $1 million and I would just build this palatial thing that would just be some drunken, nonsensical fantasia that, you know, only a coke addict could come up with. And I would just retire into there.
Why spend your own money when you can get the Hilton Hotel to build it for you?
In
the early days of our podcast, when our celebrity was a little bit higher, we were treated to visiting Barry Manilow's penthouse suite in the Hilton Hotel in Las Vegas that used to be Elvis Presley's suite and had been relatively untouched. And we went in there.
Oh, wow.
And it
was huge.
It was huge. It was bizarre. It was peach and ivory and lots of cherubs and lots of jacuzzis and hot tubs and group showers where people could watch other people, groups of people having sex.
Showers and jacuzzis.
Like, it was all designed for very wet sexual cocktail
parties. Barry Manilow never stayed there. It was his to use, but I don't think he ever stayed there because he's just like, he would just fly home every night to Palm Springs.
So we went into this one room. He said that he and his personal trainer worked in there. And I said, let's see how busy
worked.
This.
Oh, that's a euphemism.
I ran my finger across the weights. It was covered in dust.
It had not been cleaned.
He definitely put up a sweat in those workouts, but it was more in the bedroom than the workout.
But it was over the top and tacky. There's a famous picture of Elvis kind of like on this winding staircase, kind of looking down, and that was taken in that suite.
And so when we
They haven't changed anything. Oh, something like that is just a pure time capsule. You've got to keep that as a museum piece.
Well, that's the problem. It's prime real estate. And so, you know, when celebrities go to the Hilton or they're performing or it's like Cher or, you know, I think Cher was doing a show there for a while and, you know, they want to stay up there, but they're like, this is like my grandma's house. You know, it's this weird. If my grandma was a group sex addict, you know,
right. So you never know. Some people's grandmothers might have been pretty hot to trot back in the day.
Mae West, she said, I'm feeling a little tired today. How many men showed up for the interview? 8. Oh, send one home. Ashley Hoff, it's a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you so much
for creating this wonderful book. It's definitely a must grab for every queer person or every fan of Match Game for the holidays.
Well, thank you for having me. I have been enjoying your podcasts for some time, and I'm thrilled to have this formal introduction to you.
Awesome.
Well, come on back.
Come on back.
You need to come back. We're really excited about the Faye Dunaway book.
I'm excited for all the books.
I'll come. I'll talk about Breakfast at Tiffany's when that's out. I will then talk about Mommy Dearest when that is out. And if I have nothing else to talk about, I will just come out and I will just regale you all with all sorts of nonsensical talk and listen to you guys be far wittier than I am, because I'm not that bloody witty.
You have a demeanor that's very similar to like an old Broadway celebrity from the 1950s and 60s. And maybe that's just like,
well,
your passion.
I take that as a compliment.
Yeah,
of course.
Because part of it is like you have this passion for, you know, these entertainers. And it seems like, and certainly I can speak for myself, you internalize it to some degree.
Those people raised us.
Yeah. Well, that era. I mean, those people and that era, that was so much more, frankly, fun. It was a more attractive, it was a more witty, it was a more stylish era, but also it was just more fun. I think people just had more fun, and maybe today people are a little bit more uptight. I'm hoping post-election things will be a little less uptight. We'll see. We might break out into Act 3 of Dr. Zhivago and fall into revolution. I don't know. You know,
I sure
stock
hope
up on food and God knows what.
I'm
know.
Going to the store tomorrow.
There we go. There we go. Stock up. Just in case.
Yeah. The rule of thumb is if the election is still up for grabs in the middle of the Ides of March is March 14th. The Ides of December.
I don't know when the Electoral College is.
The Ides of December.
Yeah, so I believe by mid-December, if it's still up in the air, then you should worry. But up until then, write to your congressperson and pray for that, you know, cooler heads prevail in this country. Because we're in the process of a coup, you know, and the press. And part of it is like, I think people are a little bit worried about not talking about it as a coup, but it, for all practical purposes, it is a political coup.
Well, right at this point in time, we just sit and wait, you know, let the courts handle it.
Well, I mean, it's out of our direct hands. There are people who have far more guns than us who are in charge, and hopefully they will step in and say, hi, that's not how democracy works. We counted these votes. And, you know, if you're going to accept that, the House and Senate and everybody, you know, everybody from the local mayors and the dog catcher, those votes were all authentic, then why do you think the presidential numbers on the same ballots are somehow, you know,
right,
incorrectly numbered, you know?
Mm.
Well, either we have to recount everything or, you know, hello, just accept what went by. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Until then, definitely check out the worst awkward game show contestant in history, Evie Phineas. She's so funny on YouTube. And, you know, I think all the Match Game shows are on YouTube right now. So we're going to post a link to that on our website, as well as a link to the book, feastoffun.com. Check it out. Of course, we're on Patreon and social media everywhere, Feast of Fun. And of course, Ashley, where can people find you? Can people follow you?
Okay. On Facebook, I am simply Ashley Hoff, because for some reason, Facebook refused to recognize initial A, Ashley Hoff. They probably thought I was a drag queen or something. So there is also a... Exactly. There is also a Facebook page devoted to Match Game 101, a backstage history of Match Game by A. Ashley Hoff. So look it up there. I am on Instagram as well as Twitter, even though I don't do either as much or as often as I should. I'm much more of a Facebook person because you can blather on there, whereas Twitter and Instagram want you to just be really concise and edit yourself.
I just basically use Instagram to post nude photos of myself for the
I gotta check those out.
Like Mae West,
and if both of you are on there, that makes you part of the swinging 70s, you know, kind of throwback.
You know, the 70s never stopped swinging.
You know, I was a little kid and I watched that episode of All in the Family when Rue McClanahan came on with Vincent Gardena, and they were swingers.
Gardenia,
yeah.
Like the flower.
And Edith met them like through a personal ad, and she's like, I've had these friends coming over. Who are you? How'd you meet them? And then it was just like, and I was just trying to piece together what are swingers. Well, I figured that out pretty quick. So that's always been an inspiration.
Well, there you go. I mean, if anything is going to inspire you, it is Edith Bunker as a swinger.
That's right.
Or at least Rue McClanahan as a swinger. Mm-hmm. My goodness. Well, that kind of fits in with, you know, her later, mm-hmm. you know, later run work. As Blanche. Exactly. Oh. Exactly.
Which, yeah. you know, Blanche Devereaux from Golden Girls is Mae West back practically.
Yeah, yeah. And then later on when she did the Sordid Lives series, mm-hmm. you know, she was, you know, the very prim mother who nonetheless is having it on with the neighbor man. And, you know,
you got to get it where you she can. Ends up,
you got to get it wherever you can.
And sometimes that's in
what
the
this
can.
Era is all about.
Ashley, please enjoy a very sharp, dry martini from us.
I'm going to have a bottle of champagne. I'm going to open that shortly and ooh, nice. Drink up.
All right. Courtesy. Cheers.
Bubbly, just like my personality.
Mark
Goodson, Bill Todman production.
Production, yeah.
Is that right?
This has been a Mark Goodson, Bill Todman production.
Well, we'll talk about that more in a future episode. Thank you so much, Ashley.
Goodbye, Ashley. Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. Have a great night, guys.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Ashley Hoff lives in Los Feliz, California. You can get Match Game 101, a backstage history of Match Game, not Snatch Game, through our website or through the links in the show notes. Feast of Fun. Subscribe where all fine podcasts are found. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts. Honey, your mama's favorite podcast player, we're probably on there. And
there,
subscribe.
Sure.
Yeah.
I want to remind folks we can't do this podcast without your support, so if you're not a Plus member yet, sign up today at feastoffun.com/plus.
And we're going to leave you here with the theme to the Match Game, a Mark Goodson, Bill Todman production. This has been Feast of Fun.
Bye-bye.